behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We're joined by our super producer, Noel, the Gilded Age Brown, and I still have this Steelers hat.
That's right. You're still wearing the hat. It's a week later. You haven't found the real owner of the hat yet.
No one's hit me up. I've been wearing it around in hopes and like interacting with friends that I don't usually see that often in hopes that one of them will say, "Oh, there's my hat."
You do occasionally take that off, I would hope. Because maybe they won't want it back. That's all I'm saying. It's like 100 degrees here.
I didn't say it was a perfect plan, Scott. I just have a plan.
I think that's your hat now.
Oh, man.
You've made it your hat.
Well, now I'm, you know, this is gonna change some things for me. This could be big, man.
Maybe.
I'm officially, I guess, a Steelers fan.
And a hat stealer.
I'm a stealer of Steeler hats. Oh, no. All right. Okay. Well, we are back because we had begun our earlier exploration of the origin of the Pierce Arrow Motor Car Company, and there was so much cool stuff involved. This interacts with other companies. This interacts with significant moments in history with presidents.
This is a rich topic, and there's a lot to discuss, so there was no way we were going to cover it in a single episode.
We sure tried.
We did try, though. It just ran out of time. So, yeah. So how about this? Let's pick up where we left off last week.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the Pierce Arrow, the engine.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Sure. Yeah, there's a bunch of different versions of this engine now. We're getting to the point in 1910, mm-hmm. when they start this kind of decade-long, and I'll call it a formula. It's not really a formula, but it's what they call the triple lineup.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And there's basically three different chassis that you can get. You can get something called the 36, the 48, and the 66.
And they all have a 6 in front, so like the 666, 648, 636.
And the reason is because they're all six-cylinder engines at this point. They've up to six cylinders, and the 36 is 36 horsepower, the 48 is 48 horsepower, etc. So the top vehicle is 66 horsepower. Now, all cars, as I mentioned, had six-cylinder engines, and the prices range from about $38.50, which was for the 36 horsepower runabout model, up to the $7,200 66 horsepower Lando model. And, you know, within this triple lineup, I don't want you to think that there's only three versions available.
There are multiple variants.
There's like 60 or so combinations of body and chassis that were available in the 19-teens that you could have. So you could, you know, mix and match all the different bodies and chassis and get just about anything you wanted, really, from the company. So a huge variety. And these three cars in specific really, really advanced the reputation of the company. They really, you know, made its mark, I guess, for the quality and luxury that we talked about before. And these engines were so big. You know that 66 horsepower engine that horsepower engine we talked about? This is unbelievable. The displacement was 824 cubic inches.
Which is insane.
Yeah, that's a 13.5-liter engine for a six-cylinder engine. The bore, just in case you're curious, the bore and stroke was 5x7 for the six-cylinder engine. It's just an enormous and huge displacement in this
thing. Which will come into play later in the story, too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, of course, we're up to six-cylinder engines. They're gonna advance beyond this.
Yeah.
But this, again, this formula throughout the 19-teens, I guess, was really something important for the company. And they did a lot of other things, too. Like, they had electric headlights.
Yes, they had electric headlights. They had, as they go, they are at the forefront of some pretty neat, from an engineering standpoint, experimentation. I do want to say that 13.5 liter made that model the largest engine in any production vehicle in the world at the time.
Oh, cool.
And so one of their designs that will really stick out, and it's kind of a rarity, is they created a four-valve per-cylinder inline six engine, a T-head. And it was one of the few multi-valve flathead design engines ever.
Now, I might have said V6. I meant straight six. I hope I got that right earlier on. But if I didn't, that's what I meant. Mm. And later we'll talk about straight eights as well. But they're advancing the way that they're doing things. So
they're at least experimenting.
So four valve, that's pretty advanced, because prior to that, they were two valve engines. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure they still had other two valve engines use later on in their history. But, you know, I just briefly mentioned electric headlights, but that wasn't the only thing. They had, fender mounted headlights, which was a radical new design. And people were like, no, you can't do that. You can't put headlights on the fenders.
Because headlights were on either side of the radiator, and then they put them in these flared sections, housings.
Yeah, and it became kind of a signature feature of these vehicles from about 1914 on. So prior to that, 1913 is when they came out with the electric headlamps, going from the old gas lamps up to that. And, they also had a compressed air self-starter, which was unique. And then in 1914 again, along with the fender mounted headlights, they came out with an electric starter now too. So again, they're building these large, extremely powerful, very prestigious cars, and the profits at this point, around 1916, let's say, super profitable for them. They were making around $4 million annually by 1916. And, you know, here's one thing we haven't even touched on, Ben.
Yeah.
We're already into World War One era, the World War One years, I should say.
Right.
And they were helping with the effort. You hear a lot of manufacturers that just shut down and were building things for the effort. They were actually building trucks. They produced and shipped trucks for the war over to Europe, so they were part of the war effort, actually every other manufacturer, if they didn't completely shut down for those years.
Right, but they were also, they were functioning in, rarefied air. It's difficult to emphasize this, Scott, or it's difficult to overemphasize it, but let me give it a shot. So the Pierce Arrow, unquestionably a status symbol. It's got those unique headlights, and for the record, the company did allow people the option of having conventional headlights. But who's going to take that?
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
What kind of crap is that?
Well, yeah, that's baloney, is what it is. And so, Hollywood stars owned a Pierce Arrow. That's how you knew you made it, right?
Yeah.
Business tycoons owned a Pierce Arrow. Royalty of the world had one in their collection, right?
Yeah.
And they had this, there was this one section that relates to a film called Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, okay. Two things. Okay. I'm gonna do the River Kwai thing. I do have a list of notable owners that we can talk about too. You want to do that first?
Yeah.
And then we'll get to this really, really unique version. Okay. So they did have a list of notable owners on the Pierce Arrow Society page, or site rather. And I printed that out, and it was way, way longer than I thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to list, 10 or 12 names here. It ended up being three printed pages when I shrunk the type down way, way small. So I'll just hit a few highlights here. How about that?
Yes.
All right. So we mentioned that Taft owned one, right? We already said that. Woodrow Wilson, a bunch of other.
Coolidge, Hoover, FDR.
But people like Orville Wright, who's the aviation pioneer, had one. Babe Ruth, the baseball legend, had one. Ginger Rogers, a movie star. John Ringling of Ringling Brothers, the Ringling Brothers Circus. C.W. Post from Post Cereals had one. let's see. Emperor Hirohito of Japan had one as well. Glenn Curtis, the aviation pioneer. Let's see, King Gillette, who is the president of the Gillette Safety Razor Company. And these are, again, I'm really, really cherry-picking these examples here out of this list. It's a huge list. A lot of them are, heads of state, governors, things like that. King Albert of Belgium had one. Oh, Fatty Arbuckle had one. Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle. He's the silent movie comic. I swear I saw a Fatty Arbuckle car at the Peterson Museum, but I think he had I think it was a Renault that was there, if I'm not mistaken. He had a lot of cars. He was a big car guy. He's a really big car guy. I mean, big car guy. Hey, you know what? He's probably close to the size of Taft, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in physical.
Yeah, in girth.
Yeah, he was a big guy. Let's see. Charlie Chaplin. I could read this list forever. Mrs. Andrew Carnegie had one, which I found interesting.
His and her.
Yeah, but so there are a lot of notable owners, and another one was an actor, and you said The Bridge Over River Kwai, right?
Right. That's one of the films that Sessue Hayakawa is best known for.
Yeah, so he was in this movie, and at the time, in 1918, he ordered a gold-plated Pierce Arrow as a status symbol, which, this is funny, it angered American families. Because
it angered white America.
Well, that's what it did. It angered, if we're just being bold about this, about exactly what it was, it angered white America, because here is, he's He's
Japanese national.
Yeah, Japanese national.
And
he has all the money that he could ever want because he's made it in the movie industry here in the United States.
And he's throwing wild parties, doing massive amounts of drugs. He's Hollywood's first male sex symbol. And people already, you know, with the racial attitudes of the time, people are already angry at this guy.
And now he's driving around in a gold-plated car. And I mean real gold.
Like it's gold.
The body is plated in gold. It's not a wrap car. It's not, you know, like a plastic wrap or whatever you put on their vinyl.
It's not some kind of paint.
No, this is gold. It's a hammered gold-plated car. And, you know, some of the car is nickel as well, just to be fair. But it's extravagant, to say the least. And this led to... This is crazy. Around that time, this led to a lot of negative stereotypes of Asian men in the United States.
Which is...
From this one guy.
Yeah, which is weird when you think about it. For us here in 2016, you know, like nearly 100 years later, this sounds insane. But it really happened. One guy who was doing the George Clooney, Brad Pitt thing changed or influenced the opinion of millions and millions of people, and also, you know, because he had like wild parties and a lot of fun and a gold-plated car.
Yeah, sure. So it's interesting. I'm looking at a photo of this car right now. This gold-plated 1918 Pierce Arrow Model 48. It's a three-passenger coupe. And where I got this from was an RM auction site, and it says that, now I'll try to follow the order of this here, but the description, it's a right-hand drive, first of all, which is kind of unusual. 23-karat gold leaf-covered body, nickel-plated fenders, gold leaf wood-spoke wheels, silver-plated interior fittings, quarter-window curtains. I think they had silk curtains in this thing as well. It's got a known history from brand new, of course. They knew who owned it. And it was restored sometime between 1945 and 1973. And it says it's showing its age and patina, but very little use. And it looks amazing, maybe even beyond amazing, is how it's described. So take a look for that photo if you can find it. You'll know exactly which one it is. It's the mostly gold Pierce Arrow, and the front end, I guess, is the nickel-plated part, you know, the engine cover and the fenders.
Yeah.
But this thing sold for, in 2010, it sold for $141,819. And then in 2012, so just 2 years later, it went up for auction again for, it had a high bid of $150,000, but they didn't sell it at that point. And then it went up for auction again in 2013, and they were hoping to get somewhere between $200,000 to $250,000. So I don't know if that ever sold or not. I don't have any idea where the car is now. I've heard rumor that it's somewhere around like Las Vegas area. Like maybe someone owns it there. But interesting car if you ever get a chance to look at it. And, you know, Ben, when we're talking about the appearance of the vehicle, I think we should maybe mention the ads at this point.
Because
there's something really unusual about the advertising for this car.
And it's brilliant.
It really is.
Brilliant. Because what they did is, instead of necessarily extolling the virtues of a Pierce Arrow, regardless of which model it was, they sold a lifestyle. And they would have these opulent settings, you know, with either opulent settings or rugged adventurous settings with these really nice-looking people, right, or very active-looking people. And the vehicle itself, the point of the advertisement, would not be in the foreground. It would be in the background. It would be part of this lifestyle that you could buy into if only you spent $4,000 or $5,000 on a car.
Very artsy is the way I would describe them.
Very much so.
Artsy ads. And if you look at a Pierce Arrow ad, you will understand what we mean. And I'm not talking about just the ones that were printed in the newspaper. I mean not the ones
in like 1910.
No, I mean like the big full color ads that you'd see in like the New Yorker or something like that, where, you know, you'd see a fashion model holding a dog on a leash, and then somewhere in the background would be the Pierce Arrow, and they would even show the whole vehicle. It would just be the hint of a vehicle back there. And that's what they were selling. I like the way that you said that. They're selling the lifestyle. It's like, what's the other saying? Like, you sell the sizzle, not the steak, right?
Yeah,
and that's what they're doing. They're not going through the specs of these vehicles. They're just saying things like, and I'll read from one ad here. Buyers realize that Pierce Arrow Construction stands for the highest quality they can find. Detailed refinements, and they speak of qualities of comfort, durability, beauty, of course. And it says that knowledge of former Pierce Arrows does not make you conversant with the present model. So a demonstration will prove this. Mm-hmm. And then you would have to arrange for a demonstration of the models, and they would send somebody that would demonstrate the model, or you could go there and, they would demonstrate the model as well. But the ads were really, really interesting, and I find that, fascinating that they would really not highlight their own product in the ad. That's something that a lot of companies can't get away with.
And now companies do this. This approach has become incredibly popular in media around the world. For instance, I always think of this may be something that people have seen. I hope you have. I always think of when I was a kid and I would see advertisements that were apparently for cologne or perfume.
Yeah.
And it just made no sense. It was this black and white stuff with these people looking very wrought with emotion and standing by the ocean in flowing linen or something.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it would just fade out. And then there would be like, cologne, eau de mystère.
Nice. I like it. Are you a writer for maybe one of these companies?
Man, I wish I was. I would just have to write like four lines of something.
It's a piece of cake. It's got to be.
Yeah, you just pick four words that sound interesting. You'd be like, mystery, desire, boomerang, gazebo.
And for the visuals, it would just be like, just generally confuse the audience.
Yeah, exactly.
shoot anything. Doesn't matter.
For some reason, have someone holding a fish. Who knows?
Well, I mean, these ads, anyways, like, they would end with things like, eventually you will buy a Pierce Arrow, why not now? Things like that.
Yeah,
they're bold in saying that, it's like it was inevitable. It's going to happen. Why don't you just buy one right now and get it over with? But, mm-hmm. Seriously, like it's so weird the way that these ads are done compared to the way we see ads now, for automobiles, I guess.
Because automobile ads are different. Yeah,
they're different now, and I don't know. It's just an interesting way to sell your product, I think. So interesting time in the teens there with the ads.
I'd like to talk about one other thing that starts in the teens but continues.
Sure.
Okay. So we said Pierce Arrow cars are huge. Mm-hmm. Right, they have a big wheelbase. They have these massive engines. They've got a lot of room. And people aren't holding on to them forever, even though they are pretty much works of art. What's happening is that fire departments are buying used. This is the one I was most excited about.
Yeah.
Fire departments are buying used Pierce Arrow cars, and they're stripping them completely till it's nothing but that ginormous engine and the chassis. And then they lengthen the wheelbase even further. They build them in the fire engines.
I like this.
Yeah, and some of those fire engines were around for decades, man.
Yeah.
The classiest fire engines in the country.
Yeah. Do you remember? This is a while back, Ben. I've got my great-grandfather. There's a photo. You can see it online if you want. It's a photo of my great-grandfather behind the wheel of his small town's fire engine, and it was built by the blacksmith.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And I don't know, I have no idea, what type of vehicle was underneath that. But it was a custom body fire engine, and I swear to you, I mean, it's the exact same thing. It's like right around that same era, too, is when, they're buying these old, used, big, massive, really durable, reliable vehicles and creating something entirely new out of them. And of course, mm-hmm. this would be one that you would use. It has a 13 and a half liter six cylinder engine. It's strong. And of course, later they're going to have V8s and I don't even know if we'll talk about the surprise that's coming later. But
yes.
So they're very dependable, reliable vehicles that are sturdy to begin with, and they're just building them into service vehicles of all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're building tow trucks out of them. They're building fire trucks, as you mentioned. I think there's some other surprises coming along the way too that the company was responsible for, because these were not company sanctioned.
No, these other things were off market.
Yeah, ad hoc type things. People that would buy them in small towns and do what we just mentioned.
But what's cool about that to me is that it proves that there was some fire behind the smoke. They were actually, when the rubber hits the road, they were actually reliable enough to be service vehicles, because service vehicles live the most punishing existence of, aside from racing vehicles, service vehicles live the most punishing existence of cars.
We've talked about reliability so many times now. When we get to 1920, I can give you an example of how concerned they were about quality control at the factory.
Let's go there right now.
All right, so 1920, quality control was just paramount at the company. It was what their whole reputation was built
mm-hmm.
on. So each engine at the factory was run at some, they would build it, they would run it, Then they would disassemble the engine, inspect the engine, reassemble the engine, and then send it out for more testing to make sure that it was operating correctly. And they had similar quality control measures for the coachwork, you know, the bodywork. Mm. It would have almost the same type of situation where they would you know, assemble it, take a look at the way it was. If it wasn't right, they'd tear it apart. They would refine whatever they had to, put it back together again. It reminds me a lot of the way that we see, you know, when you watch the Rolls-Royce cars come together, the Bentleys come together, and you see the painstaking efforts that they make to make sure that everything fits exactly right. The gaps are correct and everything, the grains match up, all that. That was what was happening at Pierce Aero way back in the early 1900s, in the 1910s and 1920s. And, of course, you know, the cars were driven by an inspector as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was just down to every last little detail. These cars were just... every detail was well thought out, I
should say. Obsessively.
Obsessively, that's right. And only the best materials. And, you know, I found somewhere else, too, and I didn't print that because it was too much material. But I'm already drowning in paperwork. But I printed out something that had a demonstrator's kit or a salesman's kit that had, I don't know if it was film cartridges or if it was just stills. It had print materials. It had, charts that compared Pierce Aero to the competition, you know, like what you got with them, what you got with us. Mm-hmm. Photographs that showed the exact same piece of interior as you'd find in, like, a Cadillac, some of the other, Packard.
Mm-hmm.
And it would compare that with the Pierce Aero materials and just the appearance of it. Things like the silk curtains that we mentioned, you know, like little touches like that that you don't get in the other vehicles that, maybe they offered curtains, but they had linen curtains. And these had silk curtains. And,
right.
You know, take a look at the leather stitching in our car versus the leather stitching in this car. It's far superior. And just on and on like that. This kit was amazing. But, again, I couldn't print all this stuff. But they were so focused on quality in these vehicles. It was just, it's unbelievable. It's something that you rarely see even now.
So they have survived under various incarnations the horrors of World War I. And they've become an icon in the Roaring Twenties. In 1928, the Studebaker Corporation gains control of Pierce Aero. And they're in a partnership, but Studebaker is the controlling partner.
And one of the problems that started right around 1928, as you mentioned, because Studebaker would only be in control of this company for about 5 years.
Yep.
This led to some engineering and design changes within Pierce Aero, which weren't necessarily favorable. Some of the Studebaker guys got involved with the Pierce Aero manufacturing, design, engineering.
And started futzing with the engine.
Yeah, and you know what? The quality, I hate to say the quality went down, and it hurt their reputation. And not only that, we're also, you know, there's a combination of things here. It wasn't just that. Mm-hmm. It was also that we're at the onset of the Great Depression.
Exactly.
And
glad you said that.
Timing is everything, and this is not good for them because right now they're also in 1929. They're introducing what they call the L-head straight-eight engine, which is the one we mentioned just before. So it's a 366 cubic inch straight-eight engine, and of course, I think it's a Studebaker design.
Yeah, it replaces the six-cylinder they had been using, and I do believe it is a Studebaker.
Okay, so that six-cylinder is one that had hung on for a long time, but it was a solid built thing. I'm not saying anything about the quality of this engine or anything like that, but I mean, just saying that they decided to switch over to the straight eight at this time. The depression set in. They got Studebaker design and engineers in the mix there as well. Didn't work out so well, and of course Studebaker's not doing great either. Their sales numbers are way off because of the timing again. And by 1933, Studebaker's bankrupt,
right?
And of course due to low sales numbers. But the good news is that Pierce Aero company remains around for at least a little while longer. They try to hang on. It's like their last gasp, you know. It's like their last, not quite the last gasp yet, but close.
So they pull essentially a Hail Mary in 1933, and they have a radically redesigned silver Aero.
Yeah, very streamlined, right?
Yeah, streamlined. That's the word, at the New York Auto Show, and this is their last attempt to court the wealthy demographic that has supported them these years.
And this is tough, too, because you know where we are now in the timeline. We're right in the middle of the Depression.
In the worst, the pits. The fancy word would be the nadir, which is the opposite of apex.
Oh, very nice.
I, I never get a chance to use that word.
Well, I'm glad you did.
But so they managed to sell 5 Silver Arrows there.
Yeah, but you know the price, right?
I know the price was, in 1933 dollars, $10,000. $10,000.
Yeah, yeah. And as we said, that's right at the height of the worst depression.
For a single vehicle.
At the nadir.
At the nadir, yes.
See, I'm going to pick up on that. I got to use it 3 times now. Isn't that the thing? So in 2016, if you were to extrapolate that to 2016 dollars, that's $185,000. Now, imagine at the economy's worst point, trying to sell a vehicle that's $185,000, how difficult that would be. The problem here is, and there's a lot of problems here, but Pierce was the only luxury brand that even during this period didn't try to sell a lower price vehicle. They stuck with their guns on this. They wanted to just simply have that elite group of owners that they went to time and again. They didn't ever create a lower price vehicle that they could fall back on for some quick cash.
Yeah, and they tried to, as you said, Scott, they stuck around and worked on some other stuff. They made a line of camper trailers, the Pierce Aero Travel Lodge, in 36. And they also produce a very interesting another vehicle. Scott, we've been teasing it for the whole show. I think you should do the honors.
Well, they had I'll just tell you, they had a V12 sedan that they produced for a while.
V12.
Yeah.
V12.
Yeah, it was, and at the time, it was considered the safest and most luxurious sedan on the road at the time.
Best in class.
You know, in 1936, around that era, isn't that also when, I'm always really bad about this, but wasn't this around the time when Cadillac was doing V12s as well, and who else was doing V12s? There were other ones, too.
There were other V12s in 36.
There were even 16s out there. So giant engines, and I don't have an idea of the displacement of this V12 sedan. I just don't have the numbers in front of me. Again, it's one of those things that you just can't track down all that easily.
It's tough.
We had all this other history, so maybe that accounts for it. Hopefully, listeners are going to dig into this topic a little more like we always request them to do, because there's more to the story than we're able to share with you in just an hour. But, oh, Ben, another quick variation on some of these Pierce Aero cars. Rail companies were purchasing old Pierce Aero automobiles and sometimes Buicks as well, but they said Pierce Aero were the ones that they normally grabbed. And they would transform them into these motorized rail cars, cars that could drive on the rails with, all the comforts, I guess, of an automobile. And there's lots of great photos of these online. Many, many different versions of it, not just Pierce Aero, but Pierce Aero were the ones that they were favorable, I guess, for this type of application. And they said effectively these were buses and trucks on rail wheels, which is really, really cool. I mean, again, dig into some of the old, Tumblr sites. You can find lots of photos.
There's so many pictures.
I feel like I've posted a few of these old rail cars at some point. Yeah.
Well, also, interestingly enough about these is that they were less expensive to operate, and they were also lighter.
Yeah.
So they were...
Well, with the aluminum bodies. Or gold, as the case may be.
Or gold.
Well, that one didn't end up as a rail car. But
never say never.
Before we leave this V12 thing, the Pierce Aero V12 engine, or at least the equipment used to make that V12 engine, was bought by the Seagrave Fire Apparatus Company, and they used it to, again, make engines for their fire engines. So another tie-in with the fire engine companies. Fascinating stuff. So, Ben, I think we've pretty much covered everything. There's maybe a few odds and ends here that I didn't get to that we maybe will mention. But in 1938, the company ended up going defunct, and that was it. So we said they've been having financial trouble since, back in 1928, really, with the Studebaker Company, and then narrowly avoiding bankruptcy for years and years and years, and then eventually just couldn't hang on any longer. So in 1938, that's the end of the company.
Right. It was declared insolvent and had a court-ordered liquidation. So the Elmwood Avenue Corporation was established to dispose of their assets. Parts and services would still be available through the early 40s. And then in 42, the rest of the parts and the tooling of the factory, its infrastructure, it was scrapped to contribute to the war.
It's always sad when you hear about this stuff. I know the materials went to a good cause, of course, but I just always find it sad when they're dismantling companies and selling the the tooling off for metal, and it's just always,
especially because I have a soft spot for this era of these eras of cars.
Sure.
like the 34 Pierce Arrow or...
Well, you're a Packard man, too, so yeah. This is right along that line. I mean, as a competitor.
Still trying to get that Packard one day, man. Although, I would probably need to, who knows? Maybe I'll sell this Pittsburgh Steelers hat.
Yep, maybe.
I'm kidding. It's not mine. I can't sell
it. You know,
it.
Ben, there's just maybe one or two more things that I'd like to cover. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So, we had mentioned the Pierce Arrow Society a few times in this, you know, that we had gone to them for information and, you know, poked around on the site a little bit. I found a few interesting things. Our listener had written in about going to the Buffalo Transportation Pierce Arrow Museum, and I thought, well, that's the Pierce Arrow Museum. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that is not the only museum associated with the Pierce Arrow Society. The only one that is associated with the Pierce Arrow Society, so this group of owners, is a place called, what's called the Pierce Arrow Museum, mm-hmm. and it's located at the Gilmore Museum, which is in Hickory Corners, Michigan. So it's not even in New York, not even in the Buffalo area. It's in Hickory Corners, Michigan, and I had never heard of this place, but it sounds amazing. So this is just a part of it. The Pierce Arrow Museum is a segment of this bigger property that I'll tell you about. But it says since 2006, the museum has displayed an average of about 18 Pierce Arrow automobiles, a motorcycle, two bicycles, two engines, and a varied display of Pierce memorabilia, photographs, and art throughout the years. And then they have a list of what's on display right now, you know, like what's on loan, what's a donation item, you know, what's going to live there permanently. It looks pretty interesting. It has 6,400 square feet, high ceilings, motorcycles, bicycles, Pierce cars, all kinds of Pierce memorabilia that you can go and look at.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting enough. I mean, of course, you know, based on the topic we're talking about here today. But I found out that this Gilmore facility or the Gilmore Museum is this huge complex. It's 90 acres of property, and it's broken up into different museums. So the attractions inside include the Franklin Museum, the Cadillac and LaSalle Museum, the Ford Model A Museum, which was at the time under construction. There's also a Tucker and Lincoln display. And then they also have something called the Michigan Miniatures Museum. And it's really, the Miniatures Museum is like, really, really detailed small houses. It's almost like dollhouses inside a museum.
Wow.
Inside a bigger house. but all these separate museums are operating on the grounds of the Gilmore, this 90-acre complex. And I've never been there. I lived in Michigan for I don't know how long. I never heard of this place or I would have been there.
Yeah.
So Hickory Corners, Michigan. If you're anywhere near there, make time to go see some of these Pierce Arrow cars, maybe, and everything else.
Or if you'd like us to go up there ourselves on a field trip and film some stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just let our bosses know, right?
Yeah, please do. That would be so much fun. I'd love to see what they have there.
And speaking of field trips, you know, it's always a bittersweet when we get to the end of the history episodes, you know, especially if it's a company that is not around today. However, there is, as Scott pointed out, there are still opportunities to see these vehicles in action, to get under the hood, to check them out. And the Pierce Arrow Society is probably one of your best bets if you live in the United States. They have an annual meetup. I think the next one is in June, early June of 2017 in Missouri. And it's pretty cool because you get to meet all these other Pierce Arrow enthusiasts. There are 2 days of touring in the cars because they believe the cars should be driven, which I wholeheartedly agree with. I'm not one of those keep-it-in-the-package collectors.
You know, it's funny. There's a lot of museums that hold that philosophy as well.
Yeah.
And car groups, of course.
Yeah. And then they also have, you know, opportunities to trade parts, which, as you can imagine, is a very important thing in this day and age.
Yeah, can you imagine if you were just looking for that one last item, Ben, like how important these swap meets would be? Like if you're looking for that crazy hood ornament that they have, it's a really distinct hood ornament. It's called the Helmeted Archer, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah, designed by Herbert Dawley in 1914. Yeah, it stands out. And
I got to say, that's one of my...
Is that one of your favorites?
It is. There's a lot that are, you know, you can't really say you have a favorite, I don't think, because there's so many that are amazing that are out there. But it's really distinctive. It's really unique. It's something, when you see it in person, you'll understand. It's a miniature sculpture on the front of the car. And I've only seen these cars at Concours events, so very limited exposure to them. But it's just one of those, it's like a standout element of the vehicle to me. Really, really cool.
And we'd love to hear your stories with any Pierce arrows that you've run into. Maybe you're lucky enough that there was one in your family, or maybe you still have one. I'm shooting for the stars,
you know,
on that one, Scott.
You know, this happens, like, Ben. I mean, sometimes you'll see old antiques like this parked in someone's garage. You know, the kind of out of place pre-war car that's been there for decades.
Mm-hmm.
Old time owner, maybe.
And I will say, I believe they are worth restoring. Even if it's crazy expensive in terms of both money and time, and even if there's no financial return on investment immediately, my Indiana Jones comes out. You remember that line in Indiana Jones where he gets angry at someone? It's probably like one of the bad guys, and says, "It belongs in a museum." Mm-hmm. That's how I feel about these cars. And if you're lucky enough to even find one in really bad shape, I would strongly consider seeing if there is some kind of network or forum of people who might help you restore it just because they care that much about the cars.
Yeah, or get it in the hands of a museum, you know, that would professionally restore it. And appreciate it, yeah. I feel that way about them, too. I think it's definitely a piece of modern history, and there's not a lot of them out there. You know, so we mentioned early on, I think, the numbers of the very first vehicle that they built, and it was like 170, maybe. Not the failed steam vehicle, but the other one, the De Dion-powered one. The numbers of all of these, really, were relatively low production. I mean, they're very, you know, well-crafted vehicles, I guess, that took a long time to build. And I think that the production numbers were relatively low as well, you know, in the 200s in some cases.
Sure.
For an entire year run.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's not a lot of them out there, and you know, consider yourself lucky if you see them at shows, even, or even in museums.
Yeah, yes. Your luck is clearly working overtime. As a matter of fact, if you see one just randomly, go ahead and buy a lottery ticket. That's the only time I ever recommend buying a lottery ticket.
Well, they're really impressive in person. They're just a great, big, impressive vehicle, and I can see why they were status symbols when they were.
And with that, we are going to head out for the week. We will be back next week with a brand new topic, maybe inspired by a listener just like you who has sent us some sort of message on the interwebs. You can send us a message just like Steve did by finding us on Facebook or Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. If you like the origin stories of various different auto manufacturers, from specific models to entire companies, then go ahead and pop over to carstuffshow.com, where you can check out every audio podcast we've ever done. If, most importantly, you have some personal experience with one of the amazing Pierce Arrow vehicles, or even more, most importantly, you have a topic that you'd like us to cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. You can email Scott and I directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.